Welcome to the program. Every day on television, we see advertising for the latest wonder drug. The ads are filled with images of families, of health, of vibrancy. Little do these ads tell us about what really goes on behind the scenes of Big Pharma. How are these miracle drugs developed? How are they marketed and tested? And then imagine a drug that looks wonderful on paper, except that it never really worked for a disease that never really existed. We're going to talk about this today with journalist Catherine Sharp. Her work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Parade, Elle, and Fortune, among other publications. She's won 6 awards from numerous societies of professional journalism, and it is my pleasure to welcome her here today to talk about her newest work, Blood Feud, The Man Who Blew the Whistle on One of the Deadliest Prescription Drugs Ever. Kathleen Sharp, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Jeff.
Great to have you here, Kathleen. Talk a little bit about how this story came to you originally. It was really a source that approached you about it.
Well, it was. And in 2004, a man by the name of Mark Duxbury, a very charming salesman, contacted me after he'd read some of my other work. And he told me this amazing tale, which seemed too incredible to be true. And it was this, that the most admired company in the world, Johnson & Johnson, was illegally promoting and pushing high doses of its star drug, Procrit, otherwise known as EPO. And I couldn't get my mind around that. And so for 3 years, Mark kept calling me periodically every 3 months and really started kind of spoon-feeding me the elementary facts of pharmaceutical industry. And that's when I slowly began to understand this very veiled business that he was involved in. But it didn't click until 2007 when the FDA called a huge public meeting to look at how these drugs were starting to actually kill people. And that's when I realized, oh my gosh, you know, here is a national scandal unfolding in front of us, and I have sort of, you know, this witness and this bird's eye view into the drama.
One of the other things that's important to remember about this drug is that it was one of the earliest of kind of the biotech-developed kinds of drugs.
Indeed it was, and there was a lot of promise behind that. It was developed by a then small company called Amgen, and they had spent years and years trying to capitalize on this burgeoning biotech industry. And what they did is really very amazing, which was they replicated a hormone that multiplies red blood cells. In healthy people, our body does this on its own. But in anemic people, those people who undergo chemotherapy or people who are under dialysis care, they cannot multiply their red blood cells on their own. So this drug actually helped them do that, and it also helped them avoid blood transfusions, which in the 80s was kind of a scary thing given HIV.
Right. And, of course, one of the things that it was supposed to do is boost energy. It was used as an anemia drug, and it was used for the fatigue of people that were going through chemotherapy.
Right, and it's also used on the black market with Tour de France bicyclists and all kinds of other athletes, because what it does is it, you know, it multiplies and oxygenates our blood so much that we feel this surge of energy. But what people didn't quite understand is that it also thickens the blood to sludge, and it puts a huge, it taxes the heart, which has to pump your blood through your body, and at some point either has a heart attack or strokes or other health risks associated with it.
Of course, the other side effect that came to light later was that, particularly in regards to chemo, it was exacerbating the growth of tumors in some cases.
Oh, that was so horrific and so tragic, and even the FDA people that I interviewed were just, you know, agog at this. Indeed, the EPO not only multiplies red blood cells, but it multiplies tumor cells, so that the very people who are sick and need to recover are actually getting worse on this drug, studies have found.
Why wasn't this discovered early on? I mean, there was a quirk in the way this was originally approved by the FDA.
Yes, indeed, there was, and it was deemed at first to be a blood drug. And what you have to remember is that back in the heyday, or actually the birth of biotech, people didn't know how to sort of approve these drugs. And even though it was a drug, it was given to the blood division of the FDA. And after a few years, it was moved to the drug division. But by then, the drug had already been approved, and they didn't know how to sort of put the brakes on this galloping cart.
When did it become clear that there were problems with the drug, with its side effects?
Well, you know, there were discussions inside the FDA as early as the late 80s. Many people inside the FDA thought that the dosage was already too high, the dosage that Amgen and J&J wanted. And in 1989, there was actually a study that found that EPO had the potential to multiply red blood cells. But this was sort of, you know, this was never followed up on. And, of course, when some of the bicyclists in Europe started to have heart attacks or drop dead, that was another red flag. But it really wasn't until 1996 when Amgen's own studies showed that people on this drug were having heart attacks, strokes, and other serious side effects. And at each juncture, the FDA kept saying, you know, you have to test for safety in the large patient population, but neither J&J nor Amgen actually ever did that.
And why wasn't the FDA able to force them to do that?
That's a great question, and that still remains a mystery. In the book, I found that the FDA had slowly been co-opted by the very people it was supposed to regulate. One of the more shocking things I found was that the lawyer who was actually in charge of approving warning letters had come from the pharmaceutical defense industry. In other words, he was a law firm that defended people like J&J. So he prevented the FDA staff from sending out warning letters to Johnson & Johnson and, Amgen, telling them to cease their illegal promotion or to stop these wonderful, beautiful commercials that implied EPO could cure fatigue.
Mm-hmm. Of course, one of the other things with respect to the side effects is that there were then other drugs that were prescribed to deal with some of the side effects from this drug, which created other cascading impacts.
Oh, it became a quagmire, and I think that that's a huge problem today when 150 million Americans are now taking prescription drugs. That's over half of us, including children, by the way. There is so much about the drugs that we take that aren't discovered until later on. And part of it has to do with the fast-tracking of approval of the drugs at the FDA. And also it has to do with sort of the non-accountability in the pharmaceutical industry.
And, of course, what that has a lot to do with, and you talk a lot about this, is the profitability of these drugs. The, you know, follow the money does lead you to a lot of these problems.
Well, this drug, it turns out, is you know, has become a $100 billion global industry over the last 20 years or so. There's enormous amounts of money to be made, especially in cancer drugs. And I think we see some of that recently in the last few years with drugs that cost $100,000 a year. And then later are found to be not very effective. So there's a huge amount of waste and fraud going on in our healthcare system.
Of course, the Medicare system, as it is currently constituted, in some ways inherently contributes to this.
Indeed it does. So does the Department of Justice, which is supposed to be the big cop on the beat. When many whistleblowers bring their cases to the Department of Justice, they're frustrated by the lack of action that the DOJ takes on these cases. In fact, in the story of Mark Duxbury, you know, the protagonist here, he blew the whistle back in 2003, and yet, even to this day, he has still not gotten his day in court. Meanwhile, Medicare continues to pay for this drug, and taxpayers continue to foot the bill.
Why hasn't the drug been pulled from the market at this point?
Well, I think that has to do with a few things. One is that there is some benefit to dialysis patients. Two is that Amgen and J&J have huge lobbying machines. Three, I think there hasn't been enough public light put on this issue. But now that we see the super committee trying to, you know, cut the deficit and look for places to cut in Medicare and Medicaid, this type of problem might become much more important than it has in the past.
Of course, the other side of it, and some would argue that if we tighten it up too much, it may delay the bringing on the market of drugs that can have a tremendously positive impact.
Well, that's a good point, too, because, of course, some drugs are wonderful. I mean, my children take, you know, vaccines, and, you know, my father takes heart medicine. However, there has to be a balance between the risk of drugs and the benefit. And more importantly, there has to be sort of a transparency to the patient so that he or she can make the right decision. And right now, we do not have that in our system.
How much responsibility today needs to be taken by the patient?
Well, I'd say a significant amount. Mm-hmm. But in the case of EPO, the patient never could have found out what he or she needed to. In other words, there were all kinds of drug studies published by very reputable journals, and these drug studies were funded by the pharmaceutical companies themselves. They often had rosy conclusions, and many of the risks were hidden from patients for years and years.
Mm-hmm. Was there anything that Amgen or Johnson & Johnson specifically did with respect to this drug that was any different than the way they handle, market, promote, test, or do anything with any other drug?
Well, I think what we have here in Blood Feud is sort of a look on business as usual in the pharmaceutical industry. You see that pharmaceuticals like Amgen and J&J game the system by doing one or two, three things. One is that they inflate the true price of the drug and then sell it at a discount, and then they market that spread so that doctors and hospitals are actually earning a profit on that drug. Another way that they sort of game the system is by promoting drugs like EPO off-label, and that's in ways that have not been approved by the FDA. They also give free drugs to the doctors, especially oncologists, and then those doctors often turn around and bill Medicare and Medicaid for the high cost.
Talk a little bit about what goes on inside these drug companies in terms not just of marketing the drug and the advertising that we were talking about before, but the really hardcore sales effort that goes on, something that Mark Duxbury was a part of at one point, and you talk about his colleague Dean McClellan, who was setting all kinds of sales records, and his goal was just to get the stuff out there.
Well, yes, Dean was what a conflicted character we have in Dean. He would actually go into a doctor's office and offer to pay the doctor about $500 per patient, up to a few thousand dollars, if the doctor would agree to up the dose on that patient. And when the doctor got too busy to select the patients themselves, then Dean would go in the back of the office and rifle through patient records, which, of course, is illegal. And he would select those patients that he thought would be prime candidates for this faux marketing study. And then he'd pay the doctor, that everyone was happy. There were instances where Dean and actually Mark and his other colleagues took these high rollers, the real high prescribers, out on wonderful, you know, resorts, beautiful resorts in California and Santa Barbara, Hawaii, and, funded their golfing tours, had champagne, great dinners, and then would sit around and talk about how they could up the dose even higher, you know, as much as 33% to 50% higher than the approved level.
And, of course, in doing that, it was primarily to increase the usage and increase the profitability.
Absolutely.
Were there any studies done? Was there any information that indicated that increasing the dosage would have better outcomes?
There never was. There never was a solid, convincing study that showed that. In fact, even to this day, there still is no solid scientific research that shows the safe dosage of this multi-billion-dollar drug.
Was there anything in any of this that was clearly illegal?
Well, sure. There was the let me give you an example. At one point, Mark is in Seattle in 1998, January, and all of the troops, you know, for this division of J&J are assembled, and they are all told that from now on, everyone, all of their sales performances will be judged on how high the dosage they can get with their clients and how many doctors they can get on this high dosage. It was so blatantly illegal that during a cocktail hour, Mark went up to his boss and said, I bet the FDA would like to hear about this. And that was the beginning of the end for Mark. But there were, some of the people, some of the men who'd been in this industry and women for years and years had seen that as sort of business as usual, so they didn't blow the whistle. But Mark was this very quirky character who could not sleep at night unless he did something about what he saw as this illegality.
Had Mark Duxbury seen this kind of activity with respect to any other kind of drug before EPO?
No, he hadn't. And he actually worried that the high dose was not only illegal, but was dangerous to the people that he was selling it to. And the tragedy of all of this is that he turned out to be right many, many years later. But that only fortified his determination to continue to blow the whistle. And at one point, Congress even held hearings on the sharp practices of J&J and Amgen. But so far, no one has been held accountable for all of this.
Talk about the way Duxbury was treated in the company, and as you say, he was ultimately fired.
Well, Duxbury was a quirky character. He's the kind of guy that played saxophone late at night and wonderful Charlie Parker tunes, and that was part of his charm. He would, you know, he was outspoken, but when he blurted out that comment to his boss and when he made some other, you know, impolitic comments, he was squeezed very slowly by, first of all, his bosses would take away his sales account, some of the top ones. Then they'd shrink his territory, and yet they continued to hold him to a very high level of sales, you know, $3-4 million a year. And he had a nervous breakdown. And when he had that nervous breakdown, he went on medical leave, but then ironically, he was given so many different sorts of drugs that he began to hallucinate, and he began to hear voices. And his mental depression became even worse. So once he got a hold of that, he went back to work. But the harassment and the gaslighting, as I call it, just got worse and worse until, you know, there was no other way out for him.
Of course, the fact that he had a nervous breakdown was used as further evidence of his lack of credibility.
That's right. And there's this sort of gloveless torture that goes on in corporate America. And what Mark was accused of was telling an off-color joke about Viagra at a time when there were plenty of off-color jokes circulating in hospitals and waiting rooms. He was also accused of racial discrimination, which, of course, was funny because he was married to a black woman and had an African-American child. So these were trumped-up charges, you know, according to the record. And yet they were enough to chase Mark out of the company and even deny him unemployment checks for a while. So he lost his house in Seattle. He lost a lot of attraction that he had in his career. And he eventually lost his child and his family.
Did he have anyone inside either Amgen or Johnson & Johnson where he worked that was supportive of what he was trying to do?
Well, that's a great, great question. Actually, his good buddy Dean McClellan turned out to be supportive, if not quite believing in Mark's charges. Throughout the years, while Mark was, you know, suffering and sort of trying to come back up to the place he had been, he and Dean kept in touch. And at one point, Dean McClellan actually believes what Mark has been trying to tell him for years, which is that this wonderful, you know, company, Johnson & Johnson, he's worked for, is indeed playing fast and loose. And so the two men, one night, meet down in Tucson, which is where Dean lives, and they gather up 15,000 documents and all the photo albums that Dean has saved over the years. And late at night, they drive it to a copying machine, a copying place, where they Xerox and have people Xerox all night all of this evidence and then return it the next day before Dean is fired. And that became sort of the smoking gun for this entire, you know, case.
Talk about the case and the entrance of the famed lawyer Jan Schlichtman in this.
Well, Jan, you may remember, was made famous by another wonderful book called A Civil Action. And in that book, Jan represented about 8 families whose children had died from polluted waters, and Jan was up against 2 corporations. That case bankrupted him both emotionally and financially, and Jan really never went back to the law for several years. But when he heard from Mark Duxbury, who was looking for an attorney to represent him in the whistleblowing case, kind of the old fire in Jan's belly was reignited, and he agreed to take on this case, believing that he could bring Johnson & Johnson to the negotiating table. But that so far has not happened.
When you say the negotiating table, talk a little bit about what Duxbury wanted to see happen. What was his ultimate goal in this?
Well, he wanted accountability. He wanted J&J to admit it had done wrong and to make restitution to taxpayers and to the patients. It turned out that was a really high you know, high expectation. We have, however, seen Amgen recently put aside about $800 million to settle very similar kickback claims against its drug, Aranesp. So one of the key things that I'm kind of eagerly waiting for is a December 13th hearing in Boston, where the judge will call before her both J&J's representative and Jan Schlickman, and we'll see what happens, if a trial date is set or perhaps if settlement will come out of it.
There are two separate issues here, in that there's the kickbacks, there's the sales practices that went on, which were clearly illegal, but also there's the fact that the lack of transparency resulted in people dying.
Yes, and I don't know how you cure that. You know, the FDA has slapped a black box warning on the book or on the drug, and actually just in June urged people to not take this drug, to do whatever they can to stay off of it. But it's still on the market, as you point out, and we're still footing the bill. So it's a mystery why it remains so.
Kathleen Sharp, her book is Blood Feud, The Man Who Blew the Whistle on One of the Deadliest Prescription Drugs Ever. Kathleen, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Jeff. Thank you.
Thank you.